Chapter 4, Syracuse.
I went to Syracuse because of Herb Barrett, my mentor.
He was your cousin.
He was my first cousin. Herb Barrett was a very important man in my life. He was successful. He was the only cousin who really was big time. He was brilliant. He had gone to Cornell University and graduated Phi Beta Kappa. I can't remember what he majored in, but what he went into was concert management, the sort of thing that Columbia Music Artists does and the Sol Jurok organization does. It was all small time at the very beginning. He went on to become a giant in the industry. In his small time way, he opened up an office near Columbus Circle, near Carnegie Hall, in combination with another cousin, Al Sobel, who was a lawyer. Now, these two things had nothing to do with one another, except these two guys needed an office, and it was the sort of thing that they could share. I wanted to do what Herb was doing. And so the reason I got into a journalism school was to prepare myself to be a public relations person.
That's what made you choose Syracuse.
Well, four schools that accepted me. It was another question of acceptance. And fortunately, these four schools, all prestigious schools, were starving for students. Syracuse looked to Herb like the best bet. And it was Herb who chose Syracuse. And so I went on up to Syracuse with a major in journalism, minor in psychology, simply because I wondered what people thought. And engaged in a whirlwind education. Motivation can be an extraordinary thing. It had taken me 4.5 years to get out of high school. It took me 2.5 years to get a bachelor's degree from Syracuse. How was this done? This was wartime. There were 3 full semesters a year rather than 2 in order to move people faster through the educational system and into the service, and for a lot of other reasons. I was so motivated with my desire to be a hotshot public relations guy that I really applied myself. And the consequence was that going through Syracuse in 2.5 years, nonstop, I had a straight B average, except for one course in typing. I got a C, and I didn't even need to take that course because it was an extra thing that I pushed myself to take up and above the requirements. And because of that C, I didn't graduate cum laude. The Syracuse experience also was a music experience. I was the leader of a group. Well, I started out by playing with various groups around town and then had my own group. I also, because of being in journalism, became the music columnist for the Daily Orange, which was the student newspaper. So I was embroiled in music, both writing about it and talking about it. Not talking about it, playing it. Well, I was singing too, so I guess that's kind of talking. One of the engagements that I had in Syracuse was at a bar in the black section of town. It was called Goldie's. And I used to sit in there And they lost one of the musicians that was in the house band, and they hired me. And so for a spell, while I was a student in Syracuse, I was in this black band in a black club in the black part of the town and doing fine. Goldie sold out. It became Whitey's because the guy's name was White who bought the bar. And I don't know, somehow that whole thing kind of petered out, and my group at Syracuse were doing better and better. We had the gig at the campus bar where I had a five-piece group, the combo, and two piano players. We played constantly. There was no stop. When the band stopped playing, the piano player who was in the band kept on playing. When he was ready, when the band was ready to come back on, they came back on with that same piano player still playing. As soon as that tune was over, a new piano player would sit down, and we'd just go on without ever a pause in the music.
So where does the Ed Arno and his Varsity Four come in?
That was Syracuse.
That was Syracuse.
I mean, the Howard Johnson's. We had Howard Johnson, big chain, in Syracuse decided they wanted to try and see if a weekend dance policy would work. And this was a new program. And as far as I know, no other Howard Johnsons anywhere had any live music. Little. These are restaurants. Ice cream parlors.
Oh, not they weren't hotels as well. They were
No. It was just a restaurant, Howard Johnson restaurant. And I managed to sign the gig, and so we worked there for about 6 months. We went class. I had bandstands with my initials on them. The drummer had his bass drum with EA on it and his initials on it. And we wore uniforms, cheap men's wear firm at the time, Bonds. I think they're still in existence, had sport jackets. We had tan sport jackets that we bought for something like $14 a piece. And so we looked spiffy. We all wore the same ties, white shirts, tan jackets, same colored slacks. We worked weekends at Howard Johnson's. By then, I was singing nightly, King Cole style.
Were you good?
No. Some of the girls thought so, though.
You could have so easily gone in the direction of just being a professional musician. So I'm wondering how you got diverted into the journalism thing.
As I studied journalism, hoping to become a PR man, I became more and more fascinated with news as a business and the importance of information. That grew slowly in my time at Syracuse.
That was where I was always confused, because it just seems like you could have so easily gone in one direction over the other.
Yeah, actually it was a conscious decision. During my stay in Syracuse, there was another trumpet player there who was vying with me for being the hotshot trumpet player in town. His name was Georgie Horton, and Georgie had a big band. He was kind of a flake as a guy, but the band was pretty good. And he wanted me in the band, and it was a hole in what I was doing musically at the time. And so I joined the Georgie Horton band as the lead trumpeter. We played some pretty interesting charts. He had some of the Woody Herman charts, arrangements, and it was pretty exciting. And somewhere along the line, some guy, Ray McKinley's band was in town, was a name band at the time, name big band, and some of the guys from the McKinley band saw the Horton band at one of these gigs and saw me play and said, "Hey man, we need a trumpeter. You come on down and audition." That set me home thinking. You want to go on the road with Ray McKinley. You want to be a road musician with all the excitement, all the women, and all the other jazz that goes with it? Or do you want to be someone who does some thinking and establishes a life that is more mainstream? And that was a conscious decision. Mm-hmm. No, I didn't want to sacrifice journalism at the altar of music.
So you're in school at Syracuse. I remember you telling me a story once about a teacher that said you would never have a career in journalism.
Yeah. Well, again, this reflects on Herb Barrett. I had to write a thesis at the conclusion of my stay at Syracuse in order to get the degree. It wasn't a thesis, it was a long-term paper. And I chose to write it about John Hersey's book, Hiroshima. John Hersey, a very famous journalist, wrote a book that was really electrifying on what the atomic bomb did to Hiroshima and the people. And it was a novel, but it was based totally on accuracy. Herb thought this was one of the great reporting jobs he had ever seen. And I read it, of course. And in those days, I agreed with everything Herb said, but I certainly agreed with that one. And the journalism prof, I can't remember his name, gave me a passing grade, but with a lot of bad comments and grades that were mixed in. Anyhow, what he had to say was, this is a novel. This is not a journalism thing. This is not a reporter. Well, Hersey was a great reporter. This, I think, was the first novel he had ever done. Anyhow, he went on to say, you're not going to be a journalist. Try something else.
So you get out of Syracuse. You have a bachelor's.
I was the first veteran of World War II to graduate from college, having started college under government subsidy.
The GI Bill.
There was no GI Bill at the time. In World War I, a bill was passed to compensate disabled veterans with educational privileges. It was a World War I bill that sponsored my education at Syracuse. I was the first veteran of World War II to begin an education under government program, to be graduated anywhere along the entire eastern seaboard, and as far as I know, the entire United States. When I get out of Syracuse, Bernie Barrow, who is a dear, close friend of mine, no longer alive, drama major at Syracuse, we got in my car and we drove to Tosco.
Mexico.
I had 2 months prior to when classes would start at Stanford. I had already been...
You had applied and gotten accepted.
I had applied and been granted admission. Bernie and I went down. We rented a casita above a barranca, a gulch in Tosco, where we stayed for 2 months. And that's another whole story. But after I left Tosco, I drove back west, came up to Stanford, and was sitting there with that wonderful, beautiful car that almost nobody had except me. The car story is a combination of the Syracuse and Stanford story. When I was in Syracuse and a hotshot trumpet player, there were no new cars being produced at the time, but the car agencies in Syracuse decided that a great promotion would be reserving a car now for when they would be produced. All you had to come in and do is put down a deposit. So I went down to two Pontiac agencies and a Chevrolet agency, put down $2 in each of them. One of the Pontiac agencies refused my $2. One of the Pontiac agencies took my $2 and gave me a receipt. The Chevrolet agency took my $2 and gave me a receipt. And when I don't know how much later, probably a year or more later, cars were suddenly coming off the assembly lines again. The Office of Price Administration ruled that any deposits on items made had to be honored. And they also set the price of the new cars. Everything was price control. I ended up getting a Pontiac and a Chevrolet. The Chevrolet was going to be a convertible, but they weren't available. And the town was up in arms internally in the car dealerships. And so I could only get one car. And it turned out to be the Pontiac. It was a teardrop Pontiac, black, a 1946 Pontiac. I got the car for $1,400. There were no restrictions on what they could do to the car. They piled on $300 more in accessories, all price controlled.
Why?
Well, simply because the build, this was money coming in there, the only money they were getting.
Oh, you were paying for the accessories.
I was paying. Not only paying, this was a cash deal. My father came up with enough money for the $1,700. I don't know how the hell he did it.
Really?
But he probably borrowed it. But I got for $1,700 a car that I could have sold the day, one day later on the black market for $2,700.
Wow.
When I finally sold it a year and a half later, I got more money for it than I had paid for it.
Wow. That's amazing. So you had a car.
Had a car.
You were at Stanford.
I had a car at Stanford. And that established me as a big man on campus.
I bet.
Because I had a car, but I also was dead broke. We went through a whole go-round between me and the government about whether I could still get government support for my master's. Foolishly, when I started college, I listed as my objective a bachelor's degree. So it was finally ruled I was not eligible for GI Bill support. Previous program
that preceded
the GI Bill. So I was, this took a while to get resolved, and I was already in classes in Stanford, and so I took out a student loan, and which I obviously repaid, but that's what got me through Stanford.
This concludes Chapter 4.